What is artificial intelligence? Creative Next is about the impact of AI automation on creative work, so it is important we understand what the heck we're even talking about. To do that, we've brought on principal machine learning engineer Toby Bassetti. She's going to help us understand not just artificial intelligence, but other buzzwords like machine learning, deep learning, and data science to help guide the rest of our journey together. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, a social futurist interested in systems that will make the quality of our lives better. My co-host is Jonathan Follett, a writer, composer, and emerging tech researcher. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 2 of Creative Next, a show about future-proofing creatives in a world of AI automation. Let's get started. Popular ideas of artificial intelligence are fantastical. Some of it is based in reality, particularly in AI's ability to defeat humans in strategy games. Over the last 3 years, since AI-powered AlphaGo defeated top Go player Lee Sedol, software has quickly and ruthlessly defeated top human opponents. Almost a year later, Lebradas defeated Poker Pros, followed quickly by OpenAI vanquishing first one and then a team of human opponents in computer strategy game Dota 2. That these progressive achievements came quickly, and each with entirely different software, is what makes them remarkable. Deep Blue first defeated chess world champion Garry Kasparov way back in 1997, with technology that was different from what is being used today. It took almost 20 years from defeating top humans at chess to doing so at Go. But then the floodgates opened, as, since 2016, each year the next most complicated game was defeated. These successes are compelling. We love our games and we love competition, and only recently it was thought computers would never defeat humans at Go. But now they have. With poker, a game of bluffing and reading opponents and complex betting dynamics, many thought the machines would take a long time to win. But they already have. And a game like Dota 2, one that requires complex team play and coordination between people, would seem an entirely different challenge than the brute force steamrolling of chess and Go professionals. But now, too, Dota 2 is solved. But games are only the beginning. As this decade progressed, we enjoyed compelling science fiction movies like Her and Ex Machina that seemed like glimpses into tomorrow. They not only looked like our world today, with sentient artificial beings casually dropped in, but they coincided with the mainstream media frothing over AI even as the technology was defeating professional gamers, and magical technologies like self-driving cars were quietly appearing. All of this bluster and fuss combined to form a narrative of AI that is irresponsibly inaccurate. For all of its success in winning games, AI is nowhere near bringing us sentient beings. As in, such a thing is decades away, if it happens at all. The realities of AI are interesting and exciting, but bear little resemblance to what the mix of our imaginations and ignorance think might be possible. So, let's reset. Let's go back to the basics and try to simply understand what artificial intelligence and some of the more popular buzzwords around it really mean. For this, we're pleased to be joined by Toby Bassetti. She's a principal machine learning engineer who has worked across industries but is currently at Capital One. She is a thought leader and writer who has worked with publishing giants O'Reilly and Pearson. When she was explaining what AI and these related technologies are all about, she had one line in particular that really demystified things.
At the end of the day, for me, I my training is applied math, so I think of a lot of these things as just forms of applied math.
As someone who is not a trained expert in AI, I loved this because, as a software guy, I often think of AI simply as smarter software. The fact that Toby similarly sees it as merely an extension of mathematics is a reminder that this is not all some arcane knowledge hidden in a black box. Still, though, you and I need more fulsome definitions about this stuff, and Toby offered good takes.
Well, artificial intelligence is the notion of machines having consciousness the same way humans have consciousness. We can define AI as the ability for a machine to carry out complex sets of tasks with the ease and accuracy that a human would. Machine learning is a subset of AI that deals more with the algorithmic aspects of imbuing a machine with the capability to perform a particular task. The algorithm could be self-learning and have the ability to improve upon itself. For example, in reinforcement learning, we're thinking a lot about rewards and essentially punishments or deterrents. For example, if we're playing a game, we want to make sure that we can properly navigate the maze. So if the reward is cheese and the agent is a mouse, a dead end would be a deterrent or punishment in that example, so that the agent can successfully navigate that maze. Sometimes, though, the algorithm is explicitly taught And that's the case with supervised learning. This is where we have labels or past data that we use to predict some kind of outcome or target. Deep learning is just the methodology for training neural networks. It's used in both AI and machine learning. And so in particular, deep learning refers to having deep neural networks. So neural networks that are at least 3 layers or more. In the past, neural networks that were deep were not efficient to train, were not possible to train because of a issue around vanishing gradients. And so after the 2000s, with the advent of GPUs, it became more efficient to train neural networks with more than 3 layers. And there were also improved ways of calculating and overcoming vanishing gradients. Essentially, with the GPU, you can do a lot of the linear algebra required in training neural networks a lot faster and more efficiently.
So in summary, AI is a machine's ability to carry out tasks that a human would. Machine learning is the self-learning part of AI that is a product of the algorithms, and deep learning is an approach to teaching neural networks, an approach that is used by both AI writ large and machine learning more specifically. That all makes sense. I've always found machine learning and deep learning to be a little confusing, since they are often used adjacent to each other and both share the word learning. It is useful to understand these are distinctly different things. Another recent buzzword is data science, or the profession of a data scientist. How does that fit into our picture?
Data scientists have similar backgrounds as I do in the sense of the statistics, the applied math, etc. Sometimes they have a computer science background, sometimes they have a physics background, but they're typically not expected to productionize anything. Whereas as a machine learning engineer, I have sort of both sets of skills, analytical and software engineering skills. So typically a data scientist would hand off an algorithm to a software engineer, and that prototype algorithm or model would be handed off to a software engineer who can then productionize the code, essentially making it more efficient and, something that can run into production.
But the other part is actually the influx of data. So with the internet becoming adopted worldwide, we have people shopping on Amazon, streaming on Netflix and YouTube, the pervasiveness of social media, people, on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, you name it. So all of these actions, all of these, users, they're all generating massive amounts of data. And we actually have a term for it. We call it big data. And this is something that's actually growing in an order of magnitude of zettabytes right now. It's growing exponentially. And so you could think of like gigabytes, terabytes, petabytes, but now we're in the world of zettabytes.
The rise of the internet, and particularly driven by mobile and the accompanying Internet of Things, provided all this data as raw material to drive AI. Zettabytes. I've never heard of that term before. I'm old enough to remember when even a megabyte sounded big. Anyway, what are some of the ways that AI is using this big data?
When you have all this data, huge tech giants, you have the ability to improve customer experience, and there's enough incentive, financial incentive, to create things like the Alexa, Google Assistant, and target audiences better with recommender systems. For example, Amazon recommends things to shop for, Netflix recommends what movies to watch, and so they're improving customer experience in that way. Even with advertisers now, we have companies that are essentially ad exchanges, and are able to take a lot of the instrument data being generated and make sure that an advertiser can target the demographic they're looking to advertise to. So when I say instrument data, I'm talking about data being generated from the various tools and products on the internet, whether it's, Amazon.com, Netflix.com. And so that is a real strong monetary incentive for the proliferation and pervasiveness of AI and deep learning these days. The other thing I'm very excited about is the decentralization of applications. What I mean by decentralization is that in our world today, we have FANG companies. FANG being an acronym for Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google. A lot of the world's data actually rests in the hands of these companies. It's probably not news that a lot of these companies are gathering data about individuals, even if they're offering services, free services. People are actually paying for this data, for these services with their data. And God knows what these companies can or will do with the data once it's out of our hands.
The blockchain has really been a way to build decentralized apps. And so apps essentially where the user can take their data along with them to any app. So imagine having mobile data. So instead of being forced to leave your data when you maybe close your Facebook account, you can actually take that data with you easily to another application. Say maybe the decentralized version of Instagram. So it's not that, you know, once you leave, the company still have your data and can still, you know, use your data and profit off your data, et cetera. You have, you know, independence and sort of more rights and autonomy with your own data. So that's another technology that, I mean, it's not actually like super popular yet, but it's something that is being used today. And I think will gain more popularity as we kind of, as our society begins to regulate technology and, you know, as government or policymakers begin to understand technology and how to put in guards in place for you know, our nation and world.
Toby raises an important point that the big data driving AI is privately held by corporations and, increasingly, a small number of the largest corporations. There's precious little made of this and no sign of legislation to address it. Toby is bullish on decentralization and particularly enabled by the blockchain. That's where a lot of the more exciting and helpful to each of us advances could come from all of this new AI-infused technology. But the path to it isn't clear. Let's think about another thread that Toby's excited about.
I attended a conference recently called NeurIPS, and I heard from a roboticist from Georgia Tech named Ayanna Howard. She gave a keynote about creating robot therapy for special needs children. So you can imagine special needs children probably have a harder time with tasks that non-special needs children have an easier time with. For example, with speech, they would have to see a therapist to help them. Or maybe it could be with regards to behavioral improvement, because our society has a standard way that we expect people to behave as they're growing. We expect them to, for example, be quiet when others are talking or when a lecturer is presenting. We expect humans to be quiet. That kind of thing, however, is learned behavior. It is not natural per se for a human. And so a special needs child will need more therapy, more guidance in that area. Dr. Howard actually created a company that provides special needs children with a robot that is customized and adapted to provide therapy for that child. And understand the things that will incentivize the child to learn whatever the child needs to learn, especially when the child might be displaying a lot of erratic body movements, tantruming, acting out. It's really important to have the robot be able to address these things in a custom way for each child. So at being able to analyze the particular body movements of the child and adapt the therapy, you know, accordingly. This is something Ayanna's company, Dr. Howard's company, is still perfecting. And right now it only works with kids with mild disabilities, but it's pretty exciting. And it's a way to potentially increase the healthcare workforce using these robots, that's an area that the U.S. definitely has a shortage in. And in general, another thing Dr. Howard found was that humans tend to trust robots more. For some reason, when people study human-computer interaction, she in particular did a study that noticed that humans tend to favor robot judgment over their own and defer to the robot in stressful situations. So I find that pretty interesting.
Consumer-grade robots are in the news a lot lately, and they are offering increasingly more utility. While the robots of 2019 more closely resemble Seiko, a 1980s-era robot designed to treat autism in children, than they resemble Ava, their effectiveness and utility is markedly improved from the earlier models. Particularly in use cases for groups such as the elderly, the disabled, and people trying to cope with special needs, the robots of today are demonstrably making people's lives better. Just don't expect them to approximate an actual human being. In any case, Dr. Howard's research is interesting and a good place to start to learn more about service robots. So how does AI and machine learning relate to traditional software engineering?
I do a lot more math than a traditional software engineer. That's the main distinction. Software engineers is thinking in terms of traditional CS concepts, mostly computer science concepts such as web design or databases, whatever it is on the back end or front end, et cetera, mobile app development. Whereas when you're doing machine learning, you're thinking about the algorithms that can improve upon the products that are already applications in and of themselves. For example, take a banking application. Whether it's a web app or it's a mobile app, that application enables one to look at their balance, look at savings, look at their checking account, transfer money. That is some basic functionality encoded in the application. But when we go into things like we want to predict when your balance is going to fall short and try to send you a reminder, let you know not to overdraft, let you know to put more money in your account, essentially wanting to help customers have an easier time navigating the website or doing various financial tasks, that is sort of that additional insight or that additional sort of oomph to the application that we think of as machine learning. So for example, to address issues with customers navigating the website, we could create a chatbot within the application, the banking application. And so that additional intelligence falls into the realm of what a machine learning engineer would do. Furthermore, when we're thinking about predicting things, a lot of times we're thinking about things like likelihoods and probabilities. Even in terms of the chatbot, we have things called language models, topic models, sentiment models, or sentiment analysis. All of these things are very highly mathematical objects. So these are some ways that my work differs from a traditional software engineer. I'm not so much creating pure applications because software engineering isn't necessarily a new discipline. It's a well-known discipline, but machine learning part is kind of like the newer, you know, more modern part in a way. And so customizing and personalizing these applications, that is kind of where the machine learning engineer shines.
It sounds like there will be plenty of work for machine learning and software engineers alike. And what should people do who are trying to pivot to machine learning mid-career?
I think there are some tools that are trying to sort of democratize ML and sort of like automate ML. There are tools like that coming out. There are a lot of packages, things like scikit-learn that you can get out of the box. They have algorithms pre-built. So I think there's some basic ML that you can do sort of maybe without understanding too much or getting any formal training. But ML is a specialized field, so it does require specialized training. And a lot of that does come in the form of formal training. I think it's pretty difficult to get into ML without any formal training.
Wrapping up the interview, Toby expresses concerns about AI technologies and the importance of vigilance from us all.
Basically, tech regulation. I think that's something that AI practitioners or creative workers will have to be very attuned to. Essentially, how what they're building will impact the world. So not just washing their hands clean of whatever they build, but having a real awareness of unintended impact. And obviously, we cannot be oracles. We're not going to be able to predict the future. We can try. I think that for so long, at least since the early 2000s, when a lot of this machine learning and AI started becoming very pervasive in the lives of people and around the world, just because of the scale, right? So the internet allowed us to scale fake news, essentially disseminate things a lot faster to the masses. And so there wasn't a lot of understanding at that time and was just the Wild West in terms of how these tech companies were operating. I think one of the biggest impacts to creative workers, engineers, scientists, researchers, entrepreneurs, anyone who's working in the field of AI is building an awareness of how we can think about the ways that tools we build can be used for the worst. So, for instance, Facebook was used for ethnic cleansing in Myanmar. And that platform was used to spread hate and violence. This was an unintended consequence that Facebook had, although I'm sure they didn't ever think in their wildest imagination that a social media platform for connecting people would be used to disconnect people, but that's what happened. Creative professionals will need to be able to take responsibilities for some of that and be able to realize that they have a part to play. It's not just something they can punt to regulators or policymakers. They're building these AI products, and so they must build them in a way such that they try to mitigate or minimize negative impacts.
Thanks again to machine learning engineer Toby Bassetti. So, John, how did our interview with Toby inform your thinking about the work we are doing with Creative Next?
Yeah, so from Toby, I learned quite a bit just about the continuum of mathematics, engineering, and all the various techniques that go into the creation of artificial intelligence behind the scenes. So for me, her descriptions of, you know, what needed to happen, that the sort of deep understanding of mathematics, this wasn't readily apparent to me in my understanding of what makes up artificial intelligence. So how this affected, you know, what I'm considering around Creative Next, I do think that in some ways the term artificial intelligence is really, like, the hype cycle around artificial intelligence is really doing a disservice to the field insofar as the way, you know, way it's translated for the public. And the reason I'm thinking that now is it's making this technology seem more like science fiction rather than, you know, what we learned from Toby, which is it's applied computer science and mathematics.
Yeah.
And I know we should probably know that already. And I know that that's sort of basic table stakes, that understanding. But it's not one that is sort of readily apparent from our conversations and our public conversations and the conversations in the media. And so why is that important? That's important because artificial intelligence, by making it sort of a sci-fi, sort of futuristic and even scary kind of technology, it makes it less accessible and less discussable and less part of sort of the continuum of our, you know, understanding of computer science.
Right.
And so for me, hearing Toby's interview, it really felt grounded, based in reality, and this thing that is being developed over time by people who are you know, smart people who are doing math, right? that's another way to look at AI. And I thought that was a valuable, a valuable understanding.
Yeah, you know, usually we answer these things sort of differently, but it was the same for me. It was, you know, the I've read definitions before, you know, I have sort of a vague idea of some of the particulars, but the way she broke down sequentially, you know, artificial intelligence is this, machine learning is this, deep learning is this, data science is this, it created clarity for me that's really helpful. So yeah, amen to that. John, what did Toby say that was the biggest surprise or new kernel of knowledge for you?
So one of the things that was sort of a new kernel of knowledge, something that struck me about Toby's interview was her discussion about how really the requirements for getting into machine learning, there's sort of a formal baseline that you need. So I think I've started to take for granted that just sort of because of the way that I entered the technology industry, there was a lot of self-taught kind of elements to it. And also, you know, sort of in the late 90s when I was exiting university, there was the web was starting to come of age, and there was just a lot of trial and error, learning by doing, sort of bootstrapping things and not necessarily attached to formal education as much. Formal education provided the springboard, of course, for a lot of people to understand the way computer science worked, et cetera. But there was a lot of development of technology that was essentially a very high form of winging it, right? So I felt that very early on in the development of a lot of web technologies, a lot of experimentation. Now, I can understand how with sort of the deep math and science requirements for something like being a practicing engineer in machine learning, how you would really need the fundamentals in place. In fact, some of our clients at our design studio, I know, have been, you know, hiring AI engineers, and these guys come with, you know, PhDs in various computer science or AI or engineering or mathematics. They have their PhDs, and then they're commanding huge salaries, unheard of salaries. But they have these credentials, highly credentialed people who are coming in and doing this coding. So I thought that really struck me, that there was this level of, like, you need your black belt, right? You need your high level of achievement in the academic side as, you know, sort of fundamentals to really participate. So is that startling? Probably not, but it was eye-opening for me anyway.
You know, you and I have talked for a long time about how science is increasingly coming into engineering and design and software, and I mean, maybe this is just an example of that in sort of an asymmetrical way, you know?
Yeah, it could be. It's interesting because we know that continuous learning is going to be important. So how do you go and retrain to be, you know, it's kind of difficult to retrain to be a machine learning engineer if you're coming from something else, right? but these are the some of the concerns I have, or some of the thoughts I have. How do you switch? How do you move into fields that have demand for people who are moving out of fields that are disintegrating or going away, or however you want to phrase it?
And I mean, some fields may not be attainable. You know, the sophistication and degree of math in machine learning just might not be realistic for a lot of folks who are in software engineering, or certainly who would struggle to get in software engineering because of math in the first place. it's sort of another barrier.
Sure. Yeah, that's an interesting comment. And you know, we're going to have to figure out some of that, because the sort of math and science jobs are presumably only going to increase, and sort of be the jobs of the future. So it's important.
Yeah, the biggest surprise for me in speaking with Toby is, you know, when she defined AI, she used the word consciousness, which I was sort of taken aback. And I think if we had a philosophical conversation, she and I, about AI today and consciousness, I think she might take that word back if we were really being rigorous about it. But of course, you know, this is an interview. People are speaking on their feet. But it really underscores how complicated all of this is. So, I mean, Toby is a machine learning pro, a senior, talented machine learning pro. And even someone in that position with her knowledge is thinking and using words like consciousness, talking about AI that's really weak or narrow AI at this point, that's single purpose tool. You know, it's certainly not a new form of life. So it's all muddy. You know, we talked at the outset here, you and I, about, we both really benefited from Toby's crisp definitions about what these things are. And yet it's so easy for it to get blurry and get confusing with a word like consciousness. That stew of sort of language and meaning sort of surprised me and really made me think.
Yeah, that's a really sort of convoluted area. I'm sure we'll dig into that more. That's many shows in and of itself.
Yeah. So, John, what did you learn from Toby that has influenced your life and how you're living today?
Yeah, I think, you know, as she spoke about sort of this idea trying to figure out how to be more fair. I don't want to use, it's not quite implementing fairness, but this idea that, especially in the creation of algorithmic products, AI-driven software, we have this opportunity, and perhaps, you know, the pitfall is that we codify our own bias in software. And so the idea of trying to see the hidden bias, being aware of fairness, it's a theme that we've talked about again and again, but for me, that sort of put a little more emphasis on it, and something that is becoming a sort of drumbeat for me, like thinking about the parts of our systems that are unfair, and how we do not want to take those into sort of the next stage of computing, of AI-driven software. We don't want to codify our mistakes. We don't want to put our mistakes in code. We want to suss those out before we start hiding them in a computer box, right?
Yeah.
We want to know what those... We want to be fair in this hopefully more fair future, right?
Yeah, that's right. And the thing I took away is really adjacent to yours. It's the unintended consequences, and that's something we also spoke with Carrie about in the first episode. But Carrie is an anthropologist; she's not a technologist, and so that's a perspective I might expect from Carrie, but not necessarily from someone like Toby. And in the design community, there's a lot of conversation about, we can't let the engineers steer the ship on AI. It needs to be a broader conversation, including designers, including a lot of different people, in order to take AI to a destination that's good for humanity, ultimately. And hearing Toby voice some of the similar things that I've heard from humanists felt great, because that is coming from engineering. It's coming from the folks who are really controlling, to some large degree, what AI is, how it will manifest. And to hear that as a far forward concern from her coming from that direction, was heartening in general, but B, it was also a big reminder of like unintended consequences are all over the place with technology. She used the Facebook example, which was a super one, and AI, the potential for more horrific unintended consequences is even greater. So just being aware and thinking in using technology and making technology, where, you know, how could this be bent? How could this be used in a way that you don't anticipate, right? It's like dynamite was invented to, you know, blow up rocks to make it easier to mine. Who would have thought we'd have atomic bombs, you know, a century later? Unintended consequences are a thing. So that's what it was for me. Each episode, we're going to finish up with a thing to think about, one question germane to what's been covered on the show today. This episode's thing to think about is, outside of government legislation, what might we be able to do to decentralize data from big corporations, ideally so that we control our own personal data? Think about that for yourself and feel free to tweet at us about it at GoCreativeNext. Creative Next is sponsored by GoInvo, a design practice dedicated to innovation in healthcare whose clients are as varied as AstraZeneca, 3M Health Information Services, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Learn more at goinvo.com. We're also sponsored by Design Museum Foundation, a new kind of museum. They believe design can change the world. They're online, nomadic, and focused on making design accessible to everyone. Their mission? Bring the transformative power of design everywhere. You can learn about their exhibitions, events, magazine, and more at designmuseumfoundation.org. Our final sponsor is BIF. As a purpose-driven firm, BIF is committed to bringing design strategy where it is needed most, healthcare, education, and public service, to create value for our most vulnerable populations. To learn more and connect, visit them at BIF.is, that's BIF.is. Please subscribe to Creative Next on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us at Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can get in touch with us at the Creative Next website, creativenext.org, or follow us on Twitter at GoCreativeNext. On Medium, we are partnered with Towards Data Science, where we publish an article to extend and build upon each episode. Check out all that Towards Data Science has to offer at towardsdatascience.com. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, whom you can reach at dniemeyer, that's D-K-N-E-M-E-Y-E-R, and my partner in crime is Jonathan Follett, who is at John Follett, that's J-O-N-F-O-L-L-E-T-T. Our guest this episode is Toby Bassetti. You can reach her on Twitter at AnitobiB, that's A-N-I-T-O-B-I-B, as well as on LinkedIn. Tweet to us with questions, comments, topics, guest suggestions, and include the hashtag CreativeNext. And of course, the home base for everything we do is at creativenext.org. We recommend you sign up for our low-volume newsletter there. Here's a clip of what you can expect to hear next time. We'll see you then.
I recently saw an Italian company making a patent for batteries that you can actually eat. So try to consider this. It is just stunning. You can eat the batteries.